Honorable Steve. By way of starting, may we request that we switch off our cellular phone? Please, take your cellular phone and switch it off. Because when it rings, whatever is being discussed at that point is not recorded. Even if it's on silent or vibration, when it rings in that mode, it covers everything that is being recorded. So please, just for this hour and a half or 2 hours that we're going to be here, I don't see us being here longer than that. So please, just switch your cellular phone off. And what I know is that those who don't comply, the phone will ring, as it always does during the hearing. So please make sure your cellular phone is off. DG, welcome. It's been a long time. We were happy to see you again. We were happy to reconnect with you after all this time. Welcome you and your delegation. I do see that in terms of the information that you've given us, the minister is supposed to be here. He's on his way. Right. What would do a DG is, well, nothing has changed. So would want to know the people who are here. I know you. I'm sure you don't know the faces that are here. And I only know two of you this side. The rest I don't. So if you could start there, introduction. National Treasury is represented as well. And then the auditors, and then members of parliament could then also introduce themselves. And then we can start our interaction.
My name is Timothy Matona. I'm the Director General of Public Enterprises.
My name is Dudumini. I'm currently the acting chairperson of FAA.
I am Yake Kwinana, the chairperson of the Audit Committee of FAA.
Good morning, Panasekha Bazadnot. I'm the acting CEO of FAA.
Good morning, my name is Orv Meyer. I'm the CEO of FAA.
Good morning, my name is Polani Baloyi from the Office of the Chairperson of FAA.
Good morning, my name is Malenga Meyer, Chief Director of the TPE.
Good morning, my name is Edwin Dessa, Financial Analyst with the Department of Public Enterprises.
Good morning, I'm the Deputy Director General of Transport at the Department of Public Enterprises, Komutomudi.
Morning, Chair, Committee Members. My name is Masiya Simukhulu. I'm the DDG responsible for legal governance and risk in the department. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And my name is Ravesh Rajal from National Treasury, responsible for transport and defense data and competition.
Right. Can we go to the auditors? Nick?
My name is Sandy Subramani from PricewaterhouseCoopers, auditors to SMA.
Paco Gumpeta, joint auditors from PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Hey, my name is Mitesh Bhutan from Accounting Joint Auditors on SA.
Good morning. My name is Tujo Masada from Gungi Joint Auditors at SA.
Good morning, Chairperson and members. I'm Seven Stu from the Auditor General of South Africa.
Right. May we have members introducing themselves? Honorable Singh?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Naren Singh, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, everybody. Dion George, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, everybody. Dion George, member of SCOPA. morning. Paul Kennedy, the member of SCOPA.
Good morning, Roy Ainsley, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, my name is Sarama, I'm a member of
Tawela rina la ka tsena tsamara wa ga tsebe jana mo le lokwa go di tsa pa mela ma tota tsa ka le bo.
Thanks very much. I'm comrade Timbangudi. I chair the committee. DG, once again, welcome. Not only have we not met for quite some time, but equally with the NTCSAA, we have had a couple of engagements in my life as the chair of this committee. And the last time we had this kind of engagement was a couple of years ago. And when I look, I see that none of the faces that are here were there at that time. And those faces that I last met then were not there in the engagement prior to the one I had with them. So there is that unfortunate consistency in terms of the turnover of faces at the very top. But maybe that's not the substantive point at this stage. Safe to say that we are happy that you have made time to be with us. As you know, our responsibility as the Committee of Parliament is to engage with the annual reports that come to Parliament and to report on them to Parliament. But it does happen at times that for us to be able to do so, we may need to have engagement of the nation, where in certain areas that lack clarity are clarified for us, so that we are able to better report. But equally to maybe even better understand the issues and the challenges that might be there for the entity. Most of us, myself, very loyal use of the SAA. We all even better for you, have no option. You might misuse that option. I have the option, but so the state and the health of the of the entity is certainly a matter of concern, in fact of interest to us. You would know, Tishi, that there have been times in the recent past that the group has been in the news for reasons that we could have preferred differently. And I suppose this becomes an opportunity for the leadership of the entity to assist us to better understand the issues at hand. Not in their generality, but insofar as they relate to the performance and the extent to which that performance is bearing on its finances. I think those are the areas of the greatest interest. And as we always say in the committee, we deal with what kills the patient. Someone has to be a post-mortem. What has happened? Why did things happen? How could they have been allowed to happen? How we're forging ahead is of interest, but it is not our primary call in terms of the role of Parliament. I'm sure the portfolio committees there, the appropriations committees are there to deal with the current and so that is the context within which we have this engagement. And I must say that the DG will always be the first to attest. It is a simple process of exchanging information, clarifying areas and points, its duration will certainly be determined by the volume of information that the entity might want to provide to members of parliament. But otherwise, having looked at that report, we are convinced that we are due for an early morning. Now, before I hand over to Comrade Roy and Singh, okay, Singh, Comrade Minister, welcome. We know you were delayed. No, welcome, Comrade Minister, and our appreciation. Every time we've had engagement with your department, your entity, you have always, without fail, been around. We appreciate that very much. Welcome. All right, I will hand over to Honorable Singh to get us going.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, colleagues, Minister. I'm afraid I can't express the same confidence you have about loyalty to SAA. Being from KwaZulu-Natal, I think many of my colleagues who have been using SAA for the last 35 years had to change airlines because SAA summarily stopped flights, direct flights from Durban to Cape Town, and I think that puts a lot of pressure on the majority of us, including Minister Malusi Kikava, who hailed from KwaZulu-Natal. Maybe a year later, whether removing that line from Durban to Cape Town here and putting it on an Africa line, which we were told we were going to do, has yielded better results for the group, and maybe somebody can reflect on that as we move on, because I think as members of Parliament, it's something that we need to know.
How do you go to Durban?
We use a opposition to SAA company, which I think none of us wanted to use, but we fought so. British Airways.
Okay. No,
thank you very much.
The Minister does have an answer, so at the appropriate time, I'm sure he will talk to that.
Thank you. Chairperson, I just would like to ask a general question before I go into the details of what the auditors have identified in the annual report. And I think this was something that came up in our discussion last week, that when you look at the annual report, we find the financial statements are the financial statements of the group, and you have subsidiaries in the group. I just received 10 minutes ago, and I was talking to the auditors at the back while having tea, the financial statements of the subsidiaries. Mango Airlines, SAC Limited, AirShare Proprietary Limited, SA Technical State-Owned, and South African Airways City Center. Now, I'd just like to know, and I'm glad the Minister is here, that in terms of tabling and then public availability of these documents, the financial statements of the subsidiaries, what is the position? We receive the annual report, but how does one get access, and does Parliament have access to the financial statements of the subsidiaries? So that will be my first general question, and then I'll proceed from there, Chair.
Comrade Minister, are we able to have a response from you or the Chairperson of the Board?
Yeah. Chair, in terms of the consolidated statements, we received the report of the airline group itself, which is a consolidated statement which will include the statements from the subsidiaries of the airline.
See, were you suggesting that the statements be made and available in the annual report? Firstly, in their separate form for each of the subsidiaries. Was I understanding you to be...
Correct, Chairperson, so that we can get an overall picture of the group and its subsidiaries to see what kind of cross-subsidization is taking place, because these are some of the questions I'm going to ask, because I haven't had a chance, and I don't think any of my colleagues have had a chance, to look at these financial statements to find out whether these subsidiaries, as subsidiaries on their own, are making a profit or loss. Are they subsidizing the SAA as an entity on its own? or what is actually happening. And these are questions we would have liked to ask if we had an opportunity to peruse these financial statements which we've just received now. So I'm asking it in that context, and whether or not, whether even if the law allows it, Mr. Minister, and I agree with you that the law allows the group statements to be made available, whether or not this cannot be also made available in future. So that if we have an engagement such as this with SCOPA or the Committee on Public Enterprises, then one can have the bigger picture and look at the bigger picture as we move forward.
I don't know what Minister would like to say, but I was thinking, Honorable Singh, why don't we have that as a recommendation in our report, which will then go to the Minister, and then we can take it up from there? Because I think the point that's making is that because they are subsidiaries, we should be able to look at the performance of each subsidiary before we look at the overall picture of the group. So,
thank you, Chair. I think we would accept that as a recommendation, because I don't think anything would be beyond the purview of SCOPA and in Parliament in general. Nothing in those reports is limited to saying that we would take that recommendation.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Minister. I just wanted to get a sense of, you know, whether you would accept the recommendation or not. The other question I wanted to ask, but I cleared with the auditors now, was, you know, what informed the change in auditors? And I was told, just for the purpose of other colleagues, that there is a rotation, and that the auditors
I suppose that's the response you should get from the entity and the minister.
All right, so one needs to ask the question, what informed the change in the auditing company that you had utilized from past to now?
The rotation would itself imply is best practice. It's the same as would apply to members of the board. As the first says, in terms of our memorandum of incorporation, we expect that the company would rotate the auditors to allow for new auditors to come into the picture and audit our books, the books of our entities. And that's what informs the rotation. You would find this out applied, especially in the previous financial year, it applied to a number of the entities in our portfolio, where the auditors would not have been rotated for quite some time, and we felt that we needed to comply with that requirement. So that at all times we are sure that we avoid any bad practice which might arise from keeping the same auditors for longer than 5 years.
So what you're saying, Mr. Minister, is that you were satisfied with the previous auditor, but it's the rotation that caused the change. Was there anything that you found in the previous auditing company that you had appointed that the group was not satisfied with or the board was not satisfied with?
As the AGM chairperson, we were satisfied with the work that the auditors had been doing.
Thank you for that. Now, the current auditors have expressed an opinion on the group financial statements, and if we turn to page 60 or 61 of the annual report, we'll find that they've listed a number of issues there. But one of the things that I'd like to ask, and then those relate to the restatement of corresponding figures, irregular expenditure, predetermined objectives, the prior year audited by predecessor auditors, which is the point they made, and compliance with laws and regulations. So whilst the group has done fairly well in terms of financial management, etc., there are particular areas that have been mentioned in the audit report to which I think we will ask questions of the CEO or the financial gurus on the side of SA. The one thing that the committee in our discussions spoke about is the way the accounting policies have been structured. Now, there has been a change in your accounting policies and in the way you express your financials in your shipments. And the fluctuation from a 779 million rand profit to a 1.37 plus minus billion rand loss from year to year is something of concern. How can a group, and we understand the situation that airlines find themselves with the economic meltdown, etc., etc. You said here that fuel prices have been partly the cause of this fluctuation. But can we get a general sense of why there has been this huge fluctuation from 779 million profit to a 1.37 billion rand loss in the kind of year that we are dealing with now?
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Minister, I would like to ask the CFO as well as the Chairperson of the Audit Committee to respond to the question of the Honourable Member.
I just hope that will not, Chair, I hope that will not be the pattern, because in terms of the law, you are the person who should be leading the accountability team to Parliament. So in as much as we appreciate that you did not come alone, you came with colleagues to input into the process, I'm just, from the back of my memory, remembering instances where chairpersons of all come here and have nothing to say, but just refer to fellow colleagues, which raise very serious questions about the work that is being done. But nonetheless, let's get a response.
Chair, may I just add this omission? In 2010 financial year, there was a 2 billion rand loss that has been identified. In 2011, it's a 779 million rand profit. And then in 2012, it's a 1.3 billion rand almost, loss. So why this jumping around from year to year?
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I can assure the committee that the change in results is not as a result of the change in accounting policy, because when we change the accounting policy, we restate the comparative numbers as well. The main reason for the loss, if you compare to the previous year, is basically, as we also indicated, the impact of the increase in the fuel price. If you exclude the impact of the fuel price alone, except the more difficult industry conditions that we operated under, we actually made an operating profit of in excess of 300 million rand. So it's primarily the change in the fuel price. In addition, we had increases in uncontrolled, what we call uncontrolled costs, like regulator charges, airport charges, etc., which also had a major negative impact on our results.
I note on page 17, the former chairperson, in one of the paragraphs, she does write about the fuel price. What do you budget as a group or as SAA for possible increases in fuel and landing and parking fees? Because one of the things that items like landing and parking fees don't just increase. No country will just tell you all of a sudden that we're increasing it. Surely they will give you advance notice. And aren't those things factored in when you put your budget before the board?
Mr. Chairperson, Honourable Singh, I think that to answer also part of your previous question in terms of the fluctuation, the global financial aviation industry has seen a destruction of value in the order of $30 billion since 2007 to 2012 during the course of the global financial crisis. So mid-range 2010, we would have seen that impact of both demand as well as cost increases. What helped SA's financial performance in the fiscal 2011 was obviously the World Cup, Soccer World Cup, that occurred in the preceding during that fiscal, that had a temporary positive impact on the organization. Specifically, as it goes to as far as questions in terms of what we use as basis for budgeting, in terms of fuel pricing, we typically use consensus forecasts from economists both locally and internationally that provide indication for an average Brent price that we can deem effective for there. Similarly, that applies to currency fluctuation. So fuel pricing obviously remains a variable. We budget for it at a certain price level. What happens in practice in the market is that when the price level gets exceeded, there's a demand fall off in the market. As you start pushing your pricing out to recover for the higher fuel pricing, you see a demand drop off in terms of revenue side. You are essentially correct in terms of regulated charges, airport charges, as well as navigation charges. And these charges are typically, we take our guide from the emissions that regulators such as, or operators such as ACLA obtain from regulators, and we do bias that into the budget. Again, the implication of that is just that on the, especially pricing to the side of the market, as you push pricing up to accommodate all these structural price increases, demand plateaus, and therefore you then get stuck in a business where aviation is highly capital intensive, where you then want to decrease your output, but of course you've got like fixed capital expenses that you still have to serve.
Thank you for that response. I'm sure colleagues will follow up later on.
Before you move on, Che, are we able to say of the impact of the fuel price, what percentage of, because said if you remove the impact of the fuel price, you would have made a profit of, say, 300 million. Now, what percentage of the of the total amount in loss will be attributed to the fuel, you know, volatility? Just so we have a sense that is it 50%, is it 80%, is it 90%, which will then say these losses are things that are completely out of your control because the fuel price is not determined by the airline.
Thank you, Chair. Approximately 35% of SA's total cost base is constituted by fuel. What makes it particularly challenging for a carrier like Southern Airways is South Africa's geographic position. We are geographically removed from the rest of the world relative to, say, European countries. So we are fundamentally more dependent. We use more fuel than your average airline, and therefore we are substantially more exposed to the price of fuel. That's in terms of the raw commodity of oil. Of course, oil is fundamentally also priced in hard currency denominations, specifically the US dollar. So to the extent that currency weakness occurs, that has got a compounding effect in terms of fuel management.
All right, no, that's fine. I'm sure I'll be interested to throw in a question later because it talks to our volumes. Most of our traffic means we're flying to faraway lands, like Germany, New York, San Francisco, whatever. We don't have high volumes flying Maputo or to Van Hook, which will be shorter distances and more people. But you want to make an addition?
Chair, just in absolute terms, the fuel cost went up by 2.3 billion rand, and increases in the fuel levies, we could only claw back about 600 million. So net impact of the increase in the fuel cost is in the region of between 1.5 and 1.8 billion rand.
And so moving forward, although we're looking at the post model, moving forward, you factored this into your current year, your 13-14 year, these possible increases.
Through the chair, Honourable Singh, yes, we do, as we do every year. It also forms a fundamental part of the re-engineering of SA business and why it becomes important for us to start looking at adopting more fuel-efficient long-range fleet aircraft. Because at the end of the day, we cannot manage the absolute price of fuel, but we can attempt to manage the volumes of fuel we utilize.
Sure.
Which begs the question, how many aircraft do we own, the FAA owns, and how many are leased out, and what are the terms of such lease agreements?
We have, in our fleet, just under 60, about 59, we own 7 aircraft. We own 7 A340 aircraft, and the others we all lease on operating lease basis.
Now, there has been a change in the board, which we all know about. There have also been changes in management in the recent past, senior management. So the question I'd like to ask, are there any obligations, contract, long-term leases, etc., that were signed by previous members of in management that are having an impact on the way forward for SA as a group now? And if so, what are those contracts, and then is it a positive or a negative impact?
Through the chair, Honourable Singh, Yes, there are some agreements that are historic in nature. A very topical one is there is a C-20 fleet acquisition. It's a narrow-body aircraft that is predominantly used on domestic and international services. This transaction was concluded in 2002, where SAA procured at that point 15 AC-20 aircraft. Through successive management, the nature of that transaction has changed. The next effect is that SAA will now start receiving delivery of these aircraft next month, starting in June, going through to 2017. These aircraft were procured at a rate marginally above market, at about 10 to 15% above market. So the committed transaction, of which SA will now receive these aircraft and start incurring lease payments. So to that extent, in terms of the narrow-body fleet, there is a 10 to 15% impact of a historic agreement done in 2002. Similarly, the AC-40 aircraft, which the CFO was referring to, these aircraft were purchased in 1999 with the best foresight in the world. Nobody at that time would have known that oil pricing would go from $20 to $120. And these aircraft are unfortunately highly fuel efficient, four-engine aircraft, and that's currently the bulk of SA's losses being generated as a consequence to that aircraft decision taken back in 1999.
Okay, just a minute. Comrade Deputy Minister, welcome. We have made a request right at the beginning that cellular phones should be switched off. Because when it rings, even if it's on silent, whatever is being said is not recorded. Please, for this hour and a half of this engagement, can we keep them switched off? Honourable Singh?
Thank you. So will I be correct in saying then from your answer that some of these historic agreements are going to have a negative impact moving forward, say for the fact that you will be getting some fuel-efficient planes, and the negative impact is to the extent of 15-20%?
That is correct, and so the narrow-body fleet. Now, as current management and management post-regional decisions, I think that active steps are trying to be taken to mitigate the impact of some of these historic decisions, but yes, you are actually correct.
Is there any...
That's
fine. Maybe just continue. I wanted to check what is the rationale for, you know, this acquisition at 10-15% above normal price. I mean, what are the basis of entering into that kind of agreement?
And you know, what are those steps, the mitigating steps that are going to be taken as we move forward? And we also read that there's a new fleet coming online, which is good news. But what impact is all of this going to have on the group and the group's financial performance moving forward?
Well, seeing the reason why these aircraft are above current market prices, as the CEO alluded to, the contract was entered into initially in 2002, and the deliveries would have been probably in the region of about 2005 and 6. The deliveries have been postponed until 2013. In the meantime, the market price, there were escalation clauses in the contract, so the contract price increased, but with that, they've introduced a new generation aircraft, the A320neo, and with the introduction of the new aircraft, the market value of the old A320s have reduced. So you've got a gap in the current market price and our existing contract price as a result of these two issues.
Why would it delay the delivery? It's almost 10 years, 2005, 2013, 8 years, 7 years.
Okay, the delays related to, and I'm going back on memory, between 2004 and 2006, when SA was removed from underneath Transnet, there was what looks to be a misunderstanding between SA management and the Transnet management. Transnet was under the understanding that they have terminated and cancelled that particular transaction, and the supplier then sought recourse, and the transaction had to be upheld. But then came the matter of SA cash flow position and the financial difficulties that it faced during the preceding years from 2005 to now, where these transactions deliveries were then deferred. And specific to Honourable Singh's question in terms of some of the steps that's being taken to try and mitigate some of these actions, as I alluded to earlier, SA is in need and requires a refleeting of its wide-body aircraft fleet. We are aiming to try and use some of the bargaining power that comes with being in the market for, for wide-body aircraft, try and see if we cannot reverse some of these aircraft, these deliveries that are yet to take place, to try and exert some market power as far as that concerns.
Would I be fair in saying that, the Honourable Minister was not there at the time, would I be fair in saying that lack of vision, poor management, poor oversight by the board at the time these lease agreements were entered into is going to have a negative impact moving forward for the SAO?
To the Chair, Honourable Singh, without aim to disown SAO's current performance, yes, it is fair to say that there is a residual impact of these decisions taken at that time, and that conceivably through better oversight and a better management of that transition, especially where SAO was moved up Transnet, would have had a beneficial impact today.
And maybe to the Minister, from your investigations, were these bona fide errors that took place at that time, or errors of judgment at that time, or is there any investigation into the nature of these contracts, who may have benefited, who may not have benefited, etc., etc., moving forward?
No, we haven't conducted any investigation to that effect, because I think we need something, should I say, terrific here, sort of, for us to arrive at any conclusion that we need to investigate the decisions taken at that time.
I seem to understand an honourable thing's question, but of course your response is correct. I think his premise that decisions were taken, contracts were entered into, which are actually somehow prejudicial to the entity, and I think that's the key point. But wrong as it is, it is not enough to launch an investigation based on that. Same way as, if my memory serves me well, the former CEO, the American, after he left, we found that the entity has entered into contracts and agreements that were actually highly prejudicial to the entity. And here we are again. We're talking about leadership that is no longer here, that has entered into agreements that are harming or are going to harm us now. And I hope you don't ask the question whether are they entering into any agreements now, which 5 years later we'll discover will be harming the entity. I think commitment is if question arises, you know, from that worry.
Yes, sir. But I think it speaks to, Mr. Minister, the quality of management and oversight that we had in the past. And we trust that now with a hands-on approach, with the quality of management and the daily management of the group of SAA and the board that you will appoint in due course, and the fact that your office will have oversight over this entity, will ensure that these kinds of things don't happen, so that when the new people come and sit in Scopa, we don't know if we'll be back in after 2014. When the new people come and sit in Scopa, they won't be saying, well, you know, it was this group here that signed some agreements and made some mistakes, and hence we have to carry that loss for another 5 years or 10 years moving forward.
We can only hope.
don't
think the minister to report, because we'll definitely assure you that there's nothing we're doing right now.
So we'll never know. We'll never know. We're talking about the post-mortem, as the chairman said. You know, kill the patient. Fortunately, you are not dead in the water as an organization, because the audit report doesn't reveal that. You've done pretty well in terms of managing your finances. But in terms of your undercapitalization and looking at PPPs and things like that, has that ever been something that SAA would have wanted to consider? Bearing in mind that you've had these these drastic increases in fuel prices, which has had a negative impact, are there any PPP arrangements that one can think of? Supposing this was an airline owned by private individuals, the corporate sector, without an injection of government, read shareholder, read taxpayer money into it, what would the state be of this group?
Now let's deal with the last part. Leave out the first part. What will be the date of the entity without the reassuring shadow of the shareholder behind it?
You know, this is the question that we keep coming back to, Chairperson, that from our understanding, SIA at the time it was taken out of Transnet was not adequately capitalized. And so you live with the consequences of that now, because the situation would have been different had it received adequate capitalization from the outset. And then we would be saying that yes, you have mismanaged the organization or failed properly to manage the organization having received adequate capitalization. We looked at this quite extensively as we're looking at this turnaround strategy that we have arrived at now. Because the company has hopped from one trouble to the next. Second year requiring the state to come to the party as the shareholder to provide it with support. Like any business, if the shareholder provided with adequate capitalization at the time they establish it, then you expect it to function as well as it can. Of course, you can't expect the difficulties to have been lesser. I think the objective situation which has been painted is your move is embarrassed. But you would expect that with that, from the outset, the situation would have been different. Perhaps the time to reverse that situation is now. So that going forward, we can be assured. And the other issue for SIA really is exactly that, as well as good management to run the company and ensure that you are able to change a number of things which at a corporate level need to be rectified. Proper decision making, faster decision making, proper strategy in place, long term strategy which is able to address the challenges faced by sector.
How did we miss the undercapitalization of FAA all along? I'm just thinking loud. Because when we first engaged with the leadership of FAA, I think the then CEO said the only solution is, as you put it, is to run this thing, as you said, you know, like a private business. Must gain all the latitude to deliver like a private business, then it's going to be fine. And that seemed to, at that point, have been the core issue that was identified. And I'm happy that you made mention of the issues around management. Because if we were to capitalize, go in money, and then you had the kind of things that we had in the past that led to all the litigations about which I'm sure we'll be interested to find out how far you are, we'll still come back to the same spot. So I'm just trying to check, you know, the balance between capitalization, a proper, you know, business case or business plan or how the entities are. A balance between the two,
and extent to which the one is more critical than the other, so that we have a holistic sense of what the issues and the challenges are, and when we offer solutions, they deal with the totality of the situation.
Sure. You know, maybe to start with that question, there was an equity partnership that was tried out with SUSE, which didn't work. We ended up having to revert to full ownership of SAE. I don't know in my mind how a public enterprise is run that is inefficient compared to a private enterprise. Because in my mind, and the commercial enterprise should be run like a commercial enterprise, whether it's owned by the state or not. Otherwise, you what's the purpose? What is it? So the thing is, the difficulties, perhaps, which is what I think the then CEO might have been saying, is that the requirements of state-owned companies does not apply to South African companies, which would be an anomaly. The requirement, meaning the commercial mandate on the one hand, and the developmental mandate on the other hand. Now, that one must reinforce one another, because you can't have a public enterprise that is run on the basis of a developmental mandate alone, no success, depends on to a department, which then can receive its revenue from the fiscus. But if it is a commercial enterprise of SMEs, the commercial mandate is the one that is then used when fully compared with to support the developmental mandate, because unlike the Department of Education and Health, which the developmental mandate is implemented through injection directly from the fiscal, in this case, the foundation generates the revenue for it to pursue the developmental mandate. So, in my opinion, this is a difficult terrain, a difficult balancing act that our companies often have to traverse and negotiate, and it's a difficult one, because in instances where we have said to some of the state-owned companies they must pursue the profit motive, they have done so at the expense of the developmental mandate. But at the same time, if you have to say to them they must pursue the developmental mandate to the extreme of the commercial mandate, you are going to run them down, and therefore many of the developmental mandate is not going to be realized. But as far as what options for the future, I think at the present moment, we are not looking at an option which would include a PPP. And in the recent past, to the extent that the agenda before the committee is the recent past, that hasn't been considered since the collapse of the SUSE partnership.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Minister, I cannot agree with you more that whether it's a privately owned company or a government owned company, I mean, you have to keep your head above water. And one must not get the sense, or the public must not get the sense, that because it is government owned, and there's a reserve of funding out there, whenever SA is in trouble, you just move from left to right and you bail them out. I think that's kind of what we want to allay the fears of the public out there, that that is not happening. And that can only happen if there's good management and a good board and good oversight over the company. And I think you've made a point in that regard. You know, I recall, Chairperson, in 2008-09, when I stepped on Finance Committee right here, members of the ruling party, a member of the ruling party and I went into the restroom during a break when we were considering a special adjustment to SAA, part of the normal MTBTS adjustment and things like that. And both of us agreed, we were talking there, that listen, we don't think we should agree that SAA should get this additional funding. And the Honourable Minister crept up on us, the former Minister of Finance, and he said, guys, please don't think like that. World Cup is coming. We need to go into the World Cup knowing that the hosting country has an airline that it can be proud of. And I think that's a strong decision. But moving forward, I think we've really got to make sure that management and policies and things like that make us feel proud of SAA as a government-owned entity. And I'm quite sure, Mr. Minister, you would have learned lessons from the Swiss Air agreement. And we can take that lessons forward in the medium to long term in possibly considering partners and things like that if we find that we cannot manage this company on a head above water basis. Looking again at post-mortem and the impact of the past on the future, on page 51 and page 99, there is a reference to contingent liabilities. Now, we understand that contingent liabilities, you cannot put an exact figure to contingent liabilities. But can the committee be briefed on the extent of possible liabilities that may incur from these actions that are being taken by some other airline companies? On page 99, the group is currently defending three actions brought by ComAir and the liquidators of Nationwide, which arise from findings by the Competition Tribunal that SAA contravened the Competition Act 89 of 1998 in agreements between SAA and various travel agents. Can we get a sense of what is happening in that regard? I don't know if you want to pause a break in transmission, Shepard. Unless I move on to my next question while I...
No. We must have this question answered.
Like I say, BC, I will apologize for break in transmission. Come to us now.
Shepard, maybe my response in that regard is that as per the brief, some of the matters are history, events, and so forth dealt with. Gulela, they are the present components have been dealt with. In fact, it's a matter that we would say it has been closed. Some talk about the recent COMAIR issue that is being dealt with, and I think that is the one that is subject to care.
Can we have the nature of the closure of COMAIR, Kulula and COMAIR, was it? I mean, what happened? Because it's reported here, so it's good for us to know what happened. How was it settled? Is it,
Minister?
Just before the explain. I think the most apparent, there is an ongoing, a current litigation by COMAIR, which is still ongoing. They are not in circuit. So when they refer to this one, they are referring to past this.
Yeah, I understand that. I just want to know how are those disputes.
I think, with Minister, what the Honourable thing is requesting.
Okay.
If you read the first sentence on page 99, it
that in previous financial years, various local and foreign jurisdiction regulatory investigations and civil claims were reported. So what you want to know is what claims are there in front of the SAA, and those that were settled, what were they about? How did they arrive? Settled, does it mean that they were exonerated or were found guilty? If we were found guilty, what had we contravened? Whatever we contravened, why did we contravene it? Or why did you contravene those laws and regulations that are in place with which we are supposed to comply?
Chairperson, my apology that we got. May I then take the committee through?
Sure.
And we stand the exposure and the gain is estimated at 220 million rand. But as of June 2013, there will be a hearing and the matter at the moment went before the advertising standards authority for adjudication. Corona subsequently made an undertaking to withdraw their advertising. However, we say regardless of that undertaking, the standards authority for advertising referred the case to the standard tribunal to consider levying penalties against Google due to the elements of hit and run advertising and egregious nature thereof. Therefore, this matter will be before court in June 2013 as per our brief. So, the process of success in my recognition is that SAA have been advised that there are strong prospects of success on various grounds, including the infringement of our trademark and cutting off. So, in this particular case, the legal costs to date have not yet been determined. I think also the exposure has not yet been determined on this particular case. We are being assisted by Rishabh Amiti, our teammate, and Horst Mayer. Thank you.
Oh, maybe let's do this. On that same paragraph on page 99, the second sentence, the third line, all pending matters of SAA and or its subsidiaries. This includes the Air Cargo, Far East Asia, and FIFA 2010 World Cup matter. What are these all about, and how have they been settled?
While they think about the answer, I think there's reference made to the AFA matters. What about the Competition Commission? Is the Competition Commission involved in the Advertising Standards Authority issues, or is it other issues that the Competition Commission are specifically involved in? I think it all falls under this whole thing of contingent liabilities and unforeseeable, unquantifiable exposure.
Yeah. Honourable Singh, specific to your question in terms of the Commission involvement in ASA, the two paths do not cross. That is a matter, is a very specific matter in terms of Kulula Lang claim to the most African airlines, or African Airways. They have no likelihood of success, and they will lose that specific case. That case, however, is referenced in the annual financials which you are referring to. And as far as the specific matter referred to in the annual report, the FIFA 2010 matter that relates specifically to a case brought by the Competitions Commission against British Airways, South African Airways, Mango and Kulula, as well as SA Express and Air Link. To the extent that these carriers got together before the Soccer World Cup and had to plan operationally. There was no price discussion at that point. However, a complaint was laid at the Competitions Commission by, I understand, a member of the public. The Commission investigated. They have not actually concluded that case seemed to have stalled, if I can put it that way. No evidence was found of any collusion, and I can attest to the fact that, as far as Mango and SA is concerned, no collusion did occur in terms of price fixing around the Soccer World Cup. The specific matter around the competitions matter of Home emanates from a case brought against SA under correction, but in 2002 and again in 2005. The case was broken down in two specific time frames, where it was alleged that SAA used its market power to exert pressure on travel agencies to get beneficial treatment and sales above other competitors in the market. A ruling was made against SAA and the Competitions Commission, which was then followed up with a civil claim on the part of Comair. That case remains in progress. The maximum liability and exposure there summed in the two cases, first period is $120 million and second period is $400 million. That case continues to be defended at present in terms of the magnitude of time that it would be settled. I trust that address.
So it's $600 million on that possible.
$520 million
possible exposure. The Chairperson, since you spoke about Centus 3, there's air cargo. Did you get a sense of how is our cargo side doing? We're making money, we're not making money. Because I think you have special cargo planes that, because our focus seems to be on passengers all the time. What's the cargo side bringing in money for us?
And we always pay in full.
I will say the cargo business is, again, for the fact that South Coast geographically removed, given the poor infrastructure that exists in Africa, it stands to reason that cargo has got a bright future on the African continent as a general line of business. Now, SA Cargo is currently operated as a division of NSA, and we avail of transfer pricing between the passenger airline and the cargo division to the extent that cargo uses SA's belly freight or belly space to transport cargo. At this point in time, cargo contributes between 7.5% and 8.5% of SA's overall revenue, and it's got margins of between 15% and 20% at present. Now, the airline is embarking on a process of refining the transfer pricing between passenger airline and the cargo operation. You're also correct that SA Cargo, as a division, operates four dedicated freighters, which predominantly uses in the domestic market as well as South Africa. So it remains a profitable side of the business, and again, we've seen examples in, for example, Ethiopian Airways, where 18% of revenue is contributed by cargo operation. SA Cargo currently controls about 60% of the domestic cargo market, and we continue to enhance and refine this business.
Earlier on, I asked the question about the Durban Cape Town airline, and you said you'll come back to it, so I just want to make sure we don't forget it, and if you'll answer it now.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I can talk to you. To my data solution for you, you wanted to miss committee meetings on Friday.
Through the chair, Honourable Singh, the reason for the motivation behind withdrawing SA services on Cape Town Durban is straightforward commercial consideration. SA out of necessity is just the fact that we need to operate and manage this airline in part in balance of our socio-economic commitments to the country, but in part on commercial lines. The Cape Town Durban route has traditionally historically been a leisure-oriented route. To the extent that when SA made the decision to withdraw from that route, it carried an average of 2 business class passengers per flight. There was no credible or substantial business class demand. The fact is that route generated losses for the preceding 5 years at an average rate for the group of between 120 and 150 million a year that was lost on that route. The decision was taken to use the company's low-cost vehicle in the form of Mango, of which I am the permanent CEO, to service that route because it's basic fact of matching supply and demand and the nature of supply and demand. Subsequent to affecting that change, I'm happy to state that that route is now the SA Group's single most profitable route, where the cost structure of Mango is matched to the actual market demand dynamics. So it is substantially profitable. All in all, it means about a 200 million rand turnaround for the route on an annual basis.
Bottom line off the record, and these are liability, Chairperson. But, Mr. Minister, you know, you speak about the developmental agenda of South Africa and the improvement, all the development of legislators, yes, I'm traveling with the owner line.
The Chairman asked the President to put MPs in their pension on the financial treatment.
But the business plan, that's not good enough. It was Honorable Angeli and myself, I think. All right, Chairperson, I'm now going to turn to the details contained in the auditor's report. Page 60, irregular expenditure. Now, we have been told by the auditors that all the irregular expenditure has been fully disclosed in the director's report. But it's 128 million rand, and we don't expect even 128 rand of irregular expenditure in a company as big as yours with all the human resources and expertise. Can you just run us through some of the nature of some of this irregular expenditure? I mean, so we have a sense and we can ask follow-up questions.
Thank you, Honourable Singh. I think I'd like to start off by echoing that not one cent in irregular or wasteful expenditure is acceptable, and it is our departure point in this company. In the year under review, there was 128 million rand, which was irregularly spent without loss to the company. And this specifically relates to contract management and often a situation where contracts were timelessly extended or service provision commenced without contract being in place for a period of time. It is simply not acceptable, and I'm also happy to say that in the most recent 12-month period, we've seen a 77% reduction in that type of irregular spend. Again, I need to emphasize that no loss was incurred by the company, and secondly, that it is simply not acceptable, and thirdly, that substantial progress has been made to the extent that new contract registers have been implemented, electronic monitoring systems in terms of contract expiry dates have been implemented, so progress has been made to correct that situation.
But one of the areas that has been cited by the director on page 52 is fruitless and wasteful when it comes to baggage and baggage claims, penalties and fines and things like that. Can you tell us what's been done about these baggage claims? Because, you know, every few months we read that they're tightening up controls, there have been all sorts of things, and you also read of people's bags, you know, without even the lock being broken, things being stolen, there are x-ray machines, all sorts of things, and it's bad advertising for the country if people from abroad come here and lose their items, their bags. I know when I check into London, definitely my bag is going to land in Tokyo. It's happened to me many times where, you know, you land in the one direction, your bag goes out. Now, why do these things happen, and what's going to be done about this baggage, loss of baggage and things like that?
Honourable Singh, I think that baggage handling is the bane of any airline person's life. Unfortunately, we operate in a world where social ills such as criminal activity and syndicates and that type of thing do exist. The value chain in terms of baggage handling traverses both the airline itself, ASA, and the third-party service provider, and that is true for airlines operating around the world. So what ASA has done in the last 12 months is focus substantially in terms of re-engineering its business processes around baggage handling. We launched a project called Project Zero, which specifically aims to reduce the number of baggage breach, baggage incidents in terms of re-routing or incorrect routing, as well as all breach on theft. Now, in the aviation industry, we work on ratios of number of bags per thousand that were forfeit or rerouted, incorrectly routed. A year ago, SAA was sitting at a ratio of 0.6 bags, just more than half a bag per thousand bags that something happened to that was not planned. I'm happy to report that ratio by April 2013 has reduced to 0.26 per thousand bags, which compares favorably with the world average. Now, again, from a service provider to a customer, if it was your bag that got forfeit, that is 100% of your bag, and we're acutely aware of that impact. So that expense that is reflected there is the cost that we incur in terms of replacing bags and so forth. We've tried to manage that actual cost by implementing substantially more rigid service level agreements with our suppliers. So to the extent that a service provider or baggage belt was to blame for damage caused to a bag, that we at least recoup that cost. But more importantly, we've actively reduced the number of baggage incidents in order to keep our customers happy.
How many bags on average do you process per day? So we can contextualize the 0.26.
Chairperson, the SAA as a brand carries in the order of 7 million passengers per annum. So on that basis, if you assume just three quarters of a bag effectively per passenger given families that travel, we easily carry in excess of 5 million baggage pieces per annum, and a ratio of approximately 0.5% of that would get affected through coverage or rerouting, incorrect routing.
My math is not that good. Let's bring it down to...
I'll do the calculation, sir.
I'm sure it is those who came late who have said switch off your cellular phone. Who said switch it off, don't put it on silent, because still, when it does that, whatever is being said is not recorded. We must look at appointing a compliance officer here during hearings. Yes, the chair of the audit committee.
Thank you, Chair. In respect of the baggage claims, last year we recorded a fruitless expenditure in amount of 3 million. The total was 4 million. Out of that, 3 million was in respect of that pilferage. I am glad to announce that this year, based on unaudited financial information, we have reduced that to 295,000 in terms of the amount. We are still not happy about it because we have introduced this project zero, and therefore we do not want any negative pilferage. It has gone down drastically. And we also have introduced some controls in respect thereof, where we have added terms in cases where we have got some capacity challenges in respect of absenteeism. And we have also enhanced automation. And we also enforced controls in respect of the service level agreement between SAA and CISPORT, where we have set specific targets and monitored their performance and imposed penalties where they have performed. That is basically what we are doing in terms of pilferage. I would also...
One, two. Continue.
I would also like to comment on page 52.
All right, may we continue.
In respect of the public finance management transgressions that were reported on page 52, in addition to the controls that we have put in place there, we also do have the PFMA compliance checklist, which basically is an addition to the compliance that we put in place. We also have got a PFMA induction and training to make sure that people do make sure that they know the PFM Act and the consequences and transgressions. We also have got the contract management system that we are implementing, and we also have got the contract checklist to make sure that all expiring contracts are taken care of, because one of the reasons for the irregular expenditure was the contracts that expired, and therefore we are now having processes in place to make sure that we do monitor those contracts. Thank you, Chair.
I'm sure Mr. Audit will ask further questions to the Audit Committee, and I'll leave it to Mr. Audit. You will know later on who Mr. Audit is in this committee. Chairperson, this irregular expenditure, now we understand there was no loss, but then contracts not signed timeously and things like that. Is there any action against any of those individuals? And I mean, can you just give us an instance of why a contract would not have been signed timeously, when people should know that they must follow legislative and financial risks?
Honourable Singh, I think that it operates, obviously, as business operates on a global basis, and to the extent that we've continued to enhance our governance framework and try and centralise matters, for example, contract execution, that is at times that the unintended consequence of leaving a station, for example, in London as an example, where a contract has not made it back into head office timeously for execution and their control. Now, inadvertently, some of the controls that you try and implement then put you at the default, in the default position. We have not, to the extent that we have found occurrences where it was willful misconduct or neglect of duties, disciplinary action has been taken. To the extent, and whilst it may not be the specific question, to the extent that any form of criminal conduct whatsoever is detected, every single criminal action is followed by dismissal and criminal prosecution afterwards.
When one looks at your KPIs and things like that, we see that you only achieved 15 of the 29 targets, and we understand from the Office of the AD that these were largely related to your losses and things like that. Can somebody speak to that, not achieving your own performance indicators that you set out for yourselves, not somebody else that puts these performance indicators for you to achieve?
Honourable thing, I think there's two explanations for it. One relates to the structural considerations, and I think as auditors would have alluded to, and these KPIs in some respects are set up that if you miss one target, you out of necessity miss the second and the third. If I can illustrate an example, you would have a target for absolute revenue. Absolute revenue is the sum total of number of passengers and the average fare paid, and you would have targets for both of those. So if you miss average revenue, out of necessity you would have missed either the average fare or the number of passengers. So you would find a penalty twice over in terms of the structure. The point is that it cannot be said that these KPIs paint an incorrect picture. If they was confronted with a difficult year in terms of both market volatility and the challenges that it faced, and intrinsically, internal to the organization, better management is a pertinent point. And it's exactly for that reason why Serbian Airways, as alluded to, embarked on this process of re-engineering and restructuring its business. Because in essence, its business model over the long term has proven to be value destructive. So to that extent, we have crafted a long-term turnaround strategy which is currently under consideration by our shareholder to address the core underlying performance of this airline and to find a better way of balancing this both socio-economic as well as commercial mandate, and find a better way of how to address and service our international route network. Because to the extent that, for example, SA generates, the bulk of SA's losses emanate from international operations, the fact of the matter is that this group contributes through the travel services that it provides, brings 50 billion rand in economic activity per annum to this country, and we support our indirectly 77,000 jobs. So we have to find better ways of doing our business in order to perform.
I suppose marketing is an ongoing thing when you say, particularly internationally, marketing it as a, you know, when you read offers by other airlines, and I won't mention the airlines, you go into the country, you spend a couple of days with an airline and you can stay over in certain class accommodation. I mean, are those kinds of things being done? And I'm sure we're not sponsoring SAA open golf days and all these fancy things that SAA used to do before, thinking that it's their own money. If you can just talk to them.
Honourable Sir, I think that let me touch on sponsorship first. My nature, coming from a low-cost carrier, is that sponsorship is a swear word. We do not give money away for free or nothing. Now, SA has adopted the exact same approach, and I'm happy to say that the sponsorship allocation has reduced substantially from where it was previously earning in the order of 150-160 million rand a year in terms of sponsorships that was given out. That has come down to, in the last year I'm under correction, but less than 5 million rand would have been allocated in sponsorship. And that allocation of sponsorships has also changed its nature. We historically, if they were sponsored in cash, if we look at the ATP tennis tour, for example, that policy has changed. They say no longer sponsors in cash whatsoever. Yes, we will support certain initiatives, especially on the social environment side. We will support initiatives, but only in a value and kind type of place. As far as general marketing is concerned, conventionalism will say to you that business enterprises typically resort to cutting the marketing budget when things become tough. But when you operate in what is fast becoming more of a commodity industry, a retailer will teach you that when conditions are tough, that's when you market, and market more. So we are actively fostering relationships with the likes of SA Tourism, who
outside the international markets are marketing our country as a destination, teaming up with them in terms of maximizing the marketing spend and more aggressively investing in South African Airways as a brand.
Thank you for that. I was thinking somewhere in the report, I think it was page 105 and all that, that have pension funds, German and other pension funds, is this for your employees that are based in those particular countries? Or?
Honourable thing, yes, that's for employed rates in each one of these geographies.
I think probably the last question arising out of the audit is the going concern issue, and I don't know, Minister, you've addressed that partly earlier on. But there was a specific 5 billion rand government guarantee effective from September 1st, 2012 through September 2014 to ensure the going concern status. Can we just hear something about that 5 billion rand and the guarantee and how is that panning out? I mean, is it just a guarantee on paper or do you think you'll want that cash injection later on?
Thank you. Honourable Singh, this 5 billion rand going concern guarantee emanated from when we finalised the annual financial statements the previous year. A cash flow calculation is done for the next coming the next 17 months to see whether the entity is in the position to actually meet its financial obligations. And the calculation indicated that we would not have sufficient cash resources. And as a result, we had to engage with a shareholder and National Treasury for assistance. And a 5 billion guarantee was approved, of which 1.5 billion was allowed for working capital purposes. And the conditions of the guarantee was to for working capital as such and risk adjustment sensitivities. Now, the remaining 3.5 billion is not available for working capital, but would be available in the event of certain market risk conditions emanating. So we'll require approval from the Minister of Finance for raising finance for that. And obviously another condition of this guarantee was the turnaround strategy. It was presented to the Minister as well. So in essence, that 5 billion guarantee means that 1.5 billion of the 5 billion guarantee is effectively being utilized and raised cash for working capital purposes.
Just a general question. On the risk profile of SAA as a growing concern, and if you had to go into the open market and you want to borrow money for whatever purposes, what do you think, how will the market react if we didn't have government as a backer?
Honourable thing, yes, obviously the risk profile of SAA as a standalone entity obviously won't be acceptable. They will always look at shareholder for support.
My very last question, Jefferson, before I know, is on the CFO's resignation in 2010. Now, since the CFO resigned in 2010, has there been any improvements or any changes in policy, is there better management? And I can't go back to 2010 because I'm getting old now, amnesia. Why did the CFO resign at that time? I mean, do we know? I can't even remember who the CFO was.
Through the chair, I think that, again, whilst I was not intimately involved, that I understood the reason for the then CFO's resignation to be related to interpersonal conflict with them. And CEO and management team. There were no, to my knowledge, other deeper underlying reasons. To the extent of performance of the CEO and the financial function within SA, I'm happy to say that I've seen an improvement in a controlled environment within SA amidst challenging conditions.
As a follow-up to that, the chairperson, the board, Mr. Minister, we heard of the board members resigning and, you know, all sorts of things. What impact is that, positive or negative impact, moving forward on SA?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Singh, for your question. Honourable Singh. The board resignation, in terms of the functioning of corporate governance and the operation with the airline, it had no impact because as soon as we learned of their resignation, we immediately appointed when that summit, we had gone to cabinet and received cabinet approval for the rotation of the majority of the board. And then I was the board going to move that somehow, don't know how, and decided to resign instead of waiting for the AGM where I would have then rotated them. So when I resigned, they were not going to be reappointed anyway. As I said before, it's pretty much like abandoning the game before the rest of the whistle. So then it was then meant, because no member would be brought approved by cabinet. This is why we are thinking that the resignation of the outgoing members to hold a special general meeting and appoint new members. And therefore created more value. The reputation of the MI was obviously inherited upon, because we ourselves were concerned at the time about, first and foremost, the reputation of the MI in the market, given the difficult challenges the MI was going through. We were concerned about the reputation of government as a shareholder in relation to how any potential future board members would be approached by this shareholder to serve on the board. And we were concerned about how the staff in the line would view this resignation, given that the resigning members did an unprecedented thing of sending employees to tell staff members that they don't mean announcing their resignation before they even told the shareholder. So that it would communicate a message to the stability, it would demoralize the staff. Unfortunately, it did not have that simple at all. Because I found our swift response assured members of staff that there was a vote. They would speak to the management and assured them that they should not panic. We were going to replace the board and life will go on. And once the new board was appointed, we then addressed the staff and urged them to carry on with their work and let us, as the leadership, both the shareholder and the board, deal with the governance and other issues affecting the MI. So, I think at the level of the operations, it did not have any impact. It just had an impact in how South Africans and ultimately the shareholders of this airline would view the airline and the going on of the airline, that people would think there is instability and chaos. In fact, there wasn't any more fully in control and we adjusted steadily to also address the industry and the rating agencies to assure them that the things were under control of the airline and we should not panic. We expected that it was going to be a turbulent period, especially given that the resigned members then became active in the media. And then unprecedented act on the part of any board members to actively try to punish the shareholder and paint the shareholder in bad light. But to contain that situation, and I think that we are past that. I think going forward, there are important lessons that we would have learned from how we would engage with instances of that nature. I don't understand, Chair, that the issues that the IRS members made the same as in asking that far. This must be any confusion of open discussion. There are other questions still to come. These questions that we have asked.
We also do look at the laws and regulations
And also we do have our internal audit and external audit, who also as part of their functions do look into that and report to us. And therefore it is an oversight for us not to specifically mention them in our audit committee report. And future honorable member, we're going to include it in the report.
That could be very useful for our purposes. And I could recommend that you go and look at the Home Affairs. Go and look at the Home Affairs Audit Committee report. That audit committee is the strength of that department. And as a result, they are getting fairly clean audits. Now really, you must ensure that audit committees don't become a weakness in the organization. But you haven't really answered my question. The long list of things on page 99 of investigations and civil claims, my question is that not at least partly as a result of a lack of internal control?
I wouldn't say our system of internal controls is 100% correct. However, we do have the processes through our system to make sure that weaknesses are prevented, and where they could not be prevented, they are detected.
No, that's fine. I think let's take it to the specific question in relation to the various claims and penalties, which creates an impression of an airline, you know, that operates like a buccaneer.
I said buccaneer, boxing everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that part, it's a case of non-compliance.
If possibly nobody, no internal control function, watching over them, overseeing their actions, reporting those actions, anticipating what could go wrong. Do you perhaps lack capacity when it comes to monitoring international legislation, international regulations, international law?
And it might be interesting to find out whether this non-compliance is an attempt to cut corners, is an attempt to cut costs, is an attempt to corner the market. But anyway, let's deal with the first part of the question. This lack of compliance, is it not part of your area of oversight?
Honorable Chair, it is part of our responsibilities as the audit committee members. And in fact, we do have quarterly reports that we are getting in terms of also the foreign issues that we need to take care of, including safety and security. In this report, Honorable Chair, it should be noted that SAA was not included in prosecution following the close of the investigation.
No, but they were suspect. They must have done something. Maybe that was the hook, and maybe they are not guilty, but they must have been up to something. But let's not pursue the matter. I think our appeal from this committee is, yes, you're doing a very good job when it comes to watching irregular expenditure. So I think our appeal, Jay, is to capacitate yourself to ensure that you also have this ability to watch international developments and to ensure you don't come up against the law. I think that's the only appeal that we are making. And also noting that you had outsourced this function, hadn't you? For some time, internal audit was not really part of your core business. You'd outsourced it to, who was it, Ernst & Young, I think. So really, maybe they should be the ones that we should be present and should be asking. But I certainly hope going forward that the current audit committee learns a few lessons from what Ernst & Young didn't do. And the result, I think, is on page 99.
Ernst & Young was terminated 17 million rand later.
One may very well ask a question. Did we get value for money? Given what I maintain, page 99 is a lack of internal control. Who was responsible for that? It had been outsourced to Ernst & Young. At a what? Cost of 17 million. Did we get value for money?
The previous chairperson in this hearing said there was no value for money. That's why they had to terminate that contract.
And finally, Audit Committee Chair, do you now have the capacity after this function was outsourced for a number of years, honestly now believe they have the capacity to fully ensure that the group complies not only with international, it's very complicated, not only international laws and regulations, but also internationally, far more complicated than any ordinary normal entity of the body. Do you have the capacity?
Thank you, Chair. Subsequent to the expiry of the contract of Ernst & Young, SAA has in-house internal audit. We appointed the chief audit executive who in turn capacitated the internal audit. We still have got some other areas where we have we are outsourcing to a panel of auditors. And where we are lacking in resources, we withdraw the resources from the panel of internal auditors. And in respect of the foreign issues like this one, foreign controls, one of the internal auditors is an international company, which therefore would take care of the issues around the other areas. And in fact, we also do receive monthly reports, quarterly reports to the audit committee to review these areas. Because now the internal audit is housed within SAA, where they have got capacity, they do bring it to the attention of the audit committee and come with recommendations, which we do support because we do not want to limit their scope, and also to make sure that they do carry out their functions, because as the audit committee, we rely heavily on them, and therefore we always they always report on capacity that that they require. And to date, I'm happy to announce that in the audit committee meeting that we had yesterday, the chief audit executive confirmed that they will be sure that they are going to meet the requirements of the plan with the resources they have available.
Thank you.
All right, before you step off that one, what percentage of the internal audit function is outsourced, and what percentage is done by your own internal capacity? Because I get a sense that, yes, you now have an internal audit function, but there are aspects of their way that is still outsourced.
Thank you, Chair. The Ernst & Young budget was about 17 million, and since we have the in-house capacity, the budget has gone down to 11 million. Out of 11 million, the 3 million is outsourced to the panel of auditors, and therefore the 11 million worth of job is done in-house.
No, no. Is it 11 million or 8 million?
11 million in total, and then 8 million in-house,
okay,
and 3 million outsourced.
Okay, all right. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairman. I've just got two questions. The first one is on page 106, and that makes reference to fees paid to the Board of Directors. Now, if I'm reading it correctly, Mr. Darker attended 9 meetings, and he was paid 870,000 rand, which is almost 100,000 rand a meeting. And Mr. Loacher attended 9 as well, and he was paid 349,000, which is obviously much less than Mr. Darker. I was just wondering, why is it so? Thank you.
Where do you see the attendance?
On page 56.
Page 56. All right. Can we get a response? Show the good doctor is raising the principle of equal work, equal pay.
Honorable Chairperson, Mr. Daga was also the chairperson of SAA Technical.
Okay. Dr. George?
So does that mean that he did other work other than indicated in this annual report.
The way the remuneration is being done, it depends on the committees that you sit in and also in the subsidiaries that you sit in. And therefore, if for instance you are the chairperson and also the chairperson's remuneration is higher than the normal members, the chairperson of the board and also the chairpersons of the committees, their remunerations are much higher than the normal members. And therefore, if for instance you sit, like for instance, if you sit as the chairperson of the SAA Technical, and he also was the chairperson of the procurement committee, and he was also the ordinary member of the board, and therefore that had contributed in him having a much higher amount than the other members.
Maybe I'm missing something. It's not absolutely clear. So, did he get paid 870,000 rand for 9 meetings, or were there more meetings for which he was paid the 870? So it was indicated elsewhere.
The way your remuneration is paid, we are paid a retainer, and therefore, regardless of whether you have attended the meeting or not, you do get paid your retainer.
So I'm not correctly saying for 9 meetings, he was paid 870,000 rand.
He would have attended the other audit committee meetings.
And where would that be indicated?
I think
That would be reflected in the annual report of the subsidiaries. Like for instance, you would see that in the annual report of SAA Technical, and you would see that in the PTPC if it is reported here.
Okay. Take us back to where we started with the Honorable thing about having the report of the subsidiaries, because that information would have been there.
Alright. Okay. Thank you very much, because obviously I was very concerned that if a member is getting paid almost 100,000 rand for a meeting, I think that is a serious problem. Then, on page 99...
Just a minute.
I think in relation to this, sir, the new remuneration standards that we have developed will address this anomaly. Because fees will no longer be paid on committee work, but on overall board attendance, and retainers will be regulated through attendance. We're trying to ensure that we don't end up with anomalies of this nature, and we don't end up paying board members higher than we have to.
Thank you. Thanks very much for clarity. I think it's very important, given if you look at what mine works are paid, for example, in comparison with what happens here, and when it's a grain on FISC at the same time, it just isn't right. Anyway, on page 99, we have got contingent liabilities. Honorable Singh did mention that. I've got a package of information on a court case that's going on somewhere apparently, Robert S. Watson versus SAA. And I won't bore you with all the details, but I'm sure you know all about it, and I don't want to get involved if there is in fact a case. But the issue is that under the continued liabilities, there is no reference to this. Now, amongst the information is an indication that SAA had offered a settlement of 8 million rand, which obviously was rejected, etc. So this thing appears to be going ongoing, and it was during the 2012 year, and therefore I would expect that it would be reflected somewhere in the contingent liability. Why is it not reflected? Thank you.
Honorable thing is, we are aware of this,
Dr. George.
Apologies. We are aware of the
this case. Obviously, we are guided by our legal counsel on what the possible outcome of such case would be. This huge claim is, according to us, baseless. We do have a provision of what we believe the amount should be that we will be liable to pay them, and that is already actually provided for.
Where is it provided?
It's under our provisions in the balance, on the balance sheet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Dr. Avi?
My question relates to clarity. The Honourable Minister said that it's not fair to expect taxpayers or ratepayers to stand to be a danger for operating expenses and so forth, and I couldn't agree with him more. I don't know, page 53, Chair, most of the reintroduction of single engine planes and so forth, narrow bodies and so forth, and I want to know, I think it's on page 53, I believe that the first Airbus plane will be delivered in 2014. I'd just like to know whether you have obtained suitable financing to pay for these particulars. Where do you know, is it on track? But I still think it's very important for this committee to know how far the negotiation has proceeded and how they've actually paid for these particular plans. I don't think it's fair to expect the taxpayers to foot the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honourable Robbie, I'll start the first portion of the answer and then pass it to CFO for the detail on the financing transaction. The first of the AC-20 aircraft will be delivered in June, 18th of June to be exact, and the second in July. We've got the further two to be delivered later in the year, and then the rest of the... Mr. Chair. The remaining 16 aircraft is slated for delivery through to the end of 2017. And as far as financing is concerned, the financing for the 13 aircraft is in place, and I'll ask the CFO to address it.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, the financing of the first 10 have been finalised. How we financed, we decided to opt for an operating lease, so we do not have to fork out a full amount of big amounts of capital because we don't have the capacity to make the full payment on outright purchase, and therefore we are actually leasing them on an operating lease basis, these aircraft.
Right, before I go to Refundi, a quick go back to Dr. George, and I'll come to you. Say something.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Thank you for the answer on that for provision that's made for the potential claim on balance sheet. Can you just indicate on my financials where exactly it is located? Give me the page, please, and line, so I can check it. Thank you.
All right. While you're checking the page, Refundi.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Page 60 and 61.
Page 60 and 61. All right.
It's mainly on the predetermined objective. Mm. The issue of the objective is set out, and the findings are that out of 29 that they said themselves, they only achieved 15, and as rated, it's 52%. My background is simply that it is mediocre. That's not no good for a performance plan for an institution like this. What is it that we promised to do going forward?
Do we have the page that Dr. George was asking for? Or we're still looking for it. Okay.
Through the chair, responding to the question specifically in terms of KPI performance and what the organisation is doing differently. Firstly, it's important to note that SA has finally stepped out of a sense of self-denial. There is no way of a part mark of 52% is simply not good enough, no matter what the operating conditions were. I'm happy to say that we institute a number of steps, one of which, of course, is the long-term turnaround strategy. But the long-term turnaround strategy itself does not take away the onus and obligation from management to manage. Now, in the year that has passed for the fiscal ending of March 2013, I'm happy to say that we reported and recorded 1.25 billion rand in cost compensation savings. One of SA's fundamental problems is that it has got a high cost base in general. It's got an inadequate capital structure, but importantly, it's got a very high cost base. So to that extent, we've generated...
What is the cost of that?
Mr. Chair, the cost component relates to a number of aspects. One is, for example, some of the aircraft decisions that I will soon discuss in greater detail, where asset holding cost for SA is to some historic reasons, higher than what it conceivably should be. Secondly, if you look at an airline, aircraft assets constitute about 10 to 15% of the total cost base. Because SA does not, unlike, say, European carriers, benefit from much east-west flying, if you look at our domestic geography, we use our aircraft less productive than most other countries. If you look at North America, for example, you can effectively use your aircraft for 18 hours a day by flying across time zones. In South Africa, we don't have that benefit. So a productive output of aircraft of our aircraft assets is at a disadvantage relative to some others. We also do suffer in situations of where some of our labor agreements are fairly restrictive. The organization in some instances require right-sizing in terms of management structures, for example. All of these factors contribute to make SA cost inefficient, and hence the airline has focused in the last 12 months fundamentally on eliminating these cost deficiencies. Now, when SA appeared in front of the committee last, I think on 17 November 2007, it was in the midst of what it termed a restructuring program, which in essence was a cash conservation exercise. What it did is it stopped buying milk and tea for its employees and therefore felt that there was going to be a fundamental change in the business. What we are trying to do now is fundamentally change the nature of how we do business. The systems we use, the processes we use, so that lots of these savings can be repeatable. So we generated 1.25 billion rand in repeatable savings in the last 12 months. Also, if we look at revenue growth in terms of more aggressively marketing, better going to market, revenue growth year on year for the fiscal ending March 9, 2013 grew by 15% relative to the year in question under review year where it only grew by 6%. So growing revenue...
Yesterday flying down to Cape Town on SAA, or is this a gentleman? He's not a South African, but he works in South Africa. And I'm looking at the... how the business gets restructured and how our costing, you know, is structured. And I'm sure there might be a very good explanation to this. You wanted to fly to South America with his family, tell them. And the ticket was costing him over 80,000. But when he went somewhere else, it was around 40,000. And I'm struggling to understand how that can be and what the implication of that vis-a-vis the other role players and how that limits our ability in terms of volumes to, you know, to enhance our cash flows. So that when we say we're changing, we don't reduce, you know, the meals we get in the flight. We hope that you then make some substantive savings that will impact on the profit there and be here, but you do something quite substantive.
Sure, I think that the combination of pricing is convoluted and ultimately complex. The only way any passenger would want to pay less than what they were charged at one point in time. And if there's got a revenue management team in place that on a day-to-day basis try to optimize, they need to try and extract the maximum they can out of at a given point in time in the day. If there's load factors in general has shown a 4% improvement in the current year, so generally from the available seats that we've got in the market, we are selling 4% more of them, which implies that we are achieving some form of equilibrium between supply and demand and the pricing component. The point of embarking on silly behavior in terms of short-terminism, thinking that we're going to cut our service provision to our customers and retain the customers, that is not what we're trying to do. What we are trying to do is simply just stop doing stupid things. As a practical case in point, if I continued flying or avoiding Libya in terms of its flight to Europe for at least 6 months after the civil war stopped, that results in more fuel burn, doesn't benefit any one of our passengers, or alternatively, we need to carry spare wheels in our aircraft. It's not like you've got to puncture mid-flight. So we've stopped doing that sort of thing that results in better fuel then. So to the extent possible, we've tried to re-engineer our business without effect or impact on our passenger base. And similarly, a lot of focus have come down into our subsidiaries. An entity like SAA Technical, for example, is contributing healthy margins to the group. The low-cost carrier, Mingo this year reported record profits. So we are trying to take a very holistic approach to how we re-engineer and restructure this business without negative effect on our customers.
Okay, all right. Have we got that page? Yes,
yes, on the trip. It's on page 58 under trade and other payables. I'm sorry, I'm used to the full detailed balance sheet, and that's obviously grouped.
Okay.
That will be under other payables under note number 34 on page 98.
Not 58, 98. 98. Oh. Just repeat that, please. Page 98.
Page 98, under other payables. We've got our general business accruals and other provisions in there.
Other payables, all right. Okay. All right. Memon?
Chairperson, thank you very much. You know, I was happy when you said the SAA is coming, and I thought when the minister was coming, he was coming straight to me and giving me my check to say, Amangena, here is your check for buying those things that have been stolen. You know, I'm sitting down and thinking aloud that why don't the people who are receiving our bags, let's say I'm from Polokwane, when they take the bag out of the Polokwane airplane and put it on the conveyor belt, then when they see that those things that they are not satisfied with, can they just hail out and say, Mama Nyana, come to our receiving counter on the ground floor, so that when I go there, I'll open up and then they see what is in. They said, they break. They will throw away the lock. Then I'm asking myself, why such a waste? Because breaking, and there's nothing that they find in place. When they find new things, they are happy. They take them away for themselves. Now I'm asking myself, when they go out of traffic to go home, whatever time they go home, are they not being checked somewhere to see that this person came in an overall in the morning, but now he's carrying a paper bag? What is in the paper bag? Because we are losing a lot of money by paying people. These bags are not being stolen, are open, and items being stolen. Can't we just devise some means? I'm giving an example. You know, in Tel Aviv, they'll take everything out of the bag while you are waiting here, and they tell you, take out. You take everything out of the bag, they take the bag, they take it back to the conveyor belt. It's still ring them bells. They go to you again, they do the same, until they are satisfied that there's nothing wrong with it. But in South Africa, why are we able to do that? Just to save, I'm sure we'll be saving South Africa Airlines a lot of money rather than paying out those things. Minister, that's it, please.
Okay. All right. Let us note that the chairperson of the audit committee has indicated that amount of money paid for baggage claim went down from 3 million to about 100,000. 194. I mean, that's an extraordinary reduction. All right. I'm sure we'll give you some time at the end if there are any issues that you may want to talk to. All right. You have another question?
I have another question.
Well,
I want to come back to the very first question Mr. Singh asked. We've only now recently got the financials for each entity.
Yeah.
It would be very useful, as we prepare to read those financial statements, which are the profit-making, which are the loss-making entities. And you give a very useful indication of page 5. Of your annual report, you say you have two operating business units. Which are those? Are they both making profit? Are they making a loss? You have four subsidiary companies. Which are those? Profit or loss? And two partner airlines. I'm assuming that's SA and Langer. No, I thought it was. Which are the two partner airlines? And again, in each case, no detail, just profit or loss. So then when we read these financials, I think we'd be better prepared to give perhaps a better understanding of what the financial position is of the group. If we could start with the two operating business units, which are they, profit or loss?
Through the chairperson, I remember, I think that the four subsidiaries is Manga, SA Technical, Airship, and SA Travel Centre. In the case of Manga, it's generated bottom line profits in 4 out of 6 years, and in the current year, it's generated some record profits. Surfing Airways Technical is profitable, was profitable last year, remains profitable in the current year. Airship is loss-making last year, and it's on a neutral position relatively last year, so in terms of performance. And Travel Center, SA Travel Center is a small business that generates profits of 500,000 and losses of 500,000 rand per year. It's insignificant. In terms of the...
What would that mean? Profits of 500,000 and losses of 500,000?
In the current year, it's a loss of 500,000. And last year, it was a loss of 2 million. The year before, it was a profit. I'm under correction of about 2 million. My point of emphasis, though, is that it's a fairly micro business in terms of its impact. In terms of the two operating divisions, that refers to SA Carlo, which, as I alluded to earlier, is a division of SA at present, even though it is a material business enterprise. And that is profitable. We do believe, however, that with additional controls and checks and balances, we'd like to isolate SA Cargo a bit more in terms of, obviously, corporatized entities such as Mango have got a full governance structure around it that isolates its financials, and you've got very, very clear visibility. Whereas divisions, you've got issues of possibly mistakes of cross-allocation of costs. The final division, or the second of the two operating divisions, is SA Voyager, the frequent flyer program, which is profit-making at this point. The two part airlines are SA Express and SA Airlink, who both operate in a franchise relationship with SA in as far as SA's code and branding is concerned.
I'm a Voyager member. Yep.
And I have a final question.
Yep.
And you reminded me about Voyager. Could you explain on page 48, and you just referenced now, that Voyager is profit-making. How do you get profit out of me as a Voyager member? I mean, are you not giving me free tickets when I use a Voyager miles? If you look at what you've said is indicated on page 48 of the annual report under operating results before finance costs, a paragraph on page 48, that passenger revenue increased by 3%, but Voyager income by 8%. So now when I turn my Voyager miles into for tickets, how are you making a profit out of me? So not all free. I'm not giving a free service.
Honourable member, I think that the old adage of no free lunch applies. Voyager does business with third-party entities, banking institutions and the like, where it provides service and earns revenue. And to the same extent, it charges a fee to SAA, for example. Conversely, SAA charges Voyager a fee when it makes available that specific seat. In the end of the end consumer, however, it is ultimately free.
It is not. As a member, I can assure you. Okay.
Yeah, Chairperson, just a follow-up on the travel center. If I can correctly, when you go for a ticket at the airport, it happened to me a few years ago, and you want to lift a ticket, you have to pay 500 rand. But if you do it on the internet, it's free. Now, I'm just talking about accessibility of people to the internet. We have internet, okay. But what about those people, you know, that don't have it and want to fly for the first time and that kind of thing? Were you adding a 500 rand now as an admin fee when you get to the airport? Is the policy still in place, and, you know, what informs it?
Honourable Member Thingy, I think that in terms of water payment policy, that it's purely just, if you look around the world in terms of applying best practice within airlines, you are generally trying to avail more of automation to the extent that you can, and you also try and prevent congregation or at airports. Airports are generally very busy places and you don't want loads and loads of people at these airports. So that's the fundamental nature of or the reason for the policy being addressed. Trying to surprisingly encourage people to use more effective means.
Just a minute, someone's phone was ringing, so obviously what you're saying was not recorded. So if you could repeat.
Thank you, Chair. So the policy body aims to change consumer behavior to a manner that is more cost-effective for the airline to deliver that type of service. Now, to the extent that we fully accept that there is, as in levels, of different levels of access to, for example, the internet, travel center, for example, operates somewhere north of 70 travel agency locations around the country where people can gain access. And our lower cost and more price-sensitive brand, in the case of Mango, for example, make these services available in ShopRite Checkers, for example, 600 stores in neighborhoods, where we try and take the transactivity to the people through the appropriate brand.
All right. I think we should be done, Company Minister. Pardon?
It's early days too. That's what I want to find out. If it's theirs, maybe one should ask this question. Minister, can't you please allow them to have maybe two planes per week, one coming from Cape Town on a Friday and the one coming from Limpopo straight to Cape Town on Friday, or the two, like the blue route was straight. Thank you.
All right. I'm sure that will be granted. I see the minister smiling.
I'm sure the minister also takes account of the Northwest.
All right, that's fine. Prime Minister, you spoke to the issue of the Argonne board. I must confess that they went out in quite a spectacular fashion, which was not casting the airline in any positive in a way. And I think it is good that you spoke to the issues, because they remained question marks, I think, in the minds of so many of us in terms of what exactly happened, how could things have gone that badly. Remembering that that same board that resigned had actually come in, taking over from a board that also did not go out covered in glory. And for them to have gone that way, with accusations and counter-accusations, allegations, and stuff like that, it was a worrying factor. But also, if there's a way of explaining the circumstances of the resignation of the CEO, because it appeared as if, to my mind, looking from the outside, it appeared as if these were all linked, and it was all linked to a sense of grievance. And yet, when we had that CEO, I think even in the annual report, there are all sorts of positive statements about having her there, and this and that, and this and that. And, you know, being someone who'd come from the family, from SA Express and all that, I think it would be important maybe to talk a little bit more around it, especially the CEO seeing that the issue around the board had been explained. Secondly, I'm not sure if Comrade Minister, there is a cap. A cap has been placed or considered to be placed. And this question, which we are not raising for the first time, arose from my experience with SAA, where board members served in more than 20 R boards, which then raised a question about their effectiveness in playing their oversight role in the entity. I'm just trying to check whether the element around a cap on the number of board membership has been considered or is being considered, and or are we aware, has there been a consideration when board members are appointed to the other commitments that they may have, which might impact on the quality of the work that they will do for the airline. And beyond that, you can have a few minutes to talk to any other issues that you think are relevant to enlighten us on the SAA and any other issues that members might have raised during the engagement that you feel you need to, you may need to talk to.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. I think we've not conscious, and I always find engagements with COPA very enlightening and helpful to the work we do ourselves as the shareholder, given that sometimes you think of us all the questions that you need to ask. And you've taken the necessary steps to address issues which arise, but other people might add on to the questions that you yourself have asked, and help you to take further action on certain items. Maybe to start with the questions that were asked. Unfortunately, I don't have the right to carry checks, not even for the department. I think it's good wisdom that the guys who talk too much must not also carry the money, because they don't talk too much with the money. I think for the refund and the damage claims, there are other people who can deal with that. I can only impress on them to improve on the We have tried to impose very stringent conditions, to impose very stringent targets on a number of issues, not only in relation to SAA, but in relation to all other state-owned companies. With regard to irregular expenditures, fruitless expenditures, wasteful expenditures, accidents for those that are accident prone. Fortunately, the SAA, that is, we will expect an airline that is very strict in terms of its safety standards. But with regard to all of those issues, including baggage handling for SAA, we want to improve even when we say we have reduced the extent of filtrage, pilferage to 0.something. We want them to improve on that. We can't even infer that to a point where no South African or no customer of SAA would say I either lost my luggage or my luggage was pilfered being handled by SAA. With regard to airlines, we don't own anything. It's a privately owned airline in which SAA has 2% quickly arise them. And that's why even the minds of many people, they can't separate earning from SME or SAX firms because it's using our code and share the code and a number of other things. But in fact, SME only has a 2% equity in earning. It's a privately owned airline. But we, in a long-term strategy, we are looking at how to optimize value in our aviation assets. We have to break up the net on the new turnaround strategy because it imposes far-reaching solutions to the aviation assets of the state. In relation to how we want to approach them, SAA Express, Mango, and the 2% equity we have in the SAA League. Quite clearly, at the present moment, because of this lack of a consolidated strategy, we find a lot of duplications, contestations among our own allies. We feel that we are not using our metal as well as we should, as well as we could. So the turnaround strategy is focusing on that. I further asked SM Express to develop all the foundation of this possible turnaround strategy, to develop their own, looking at the market which they service, and any other gaps which might exist in the present turnaround strategy, to come out of the woods a little bit. We are going to change the structure of ownership of all these assets so that they don't exist on independent from one another. Rather than just be independent from one another, but in terms of government and shareholder model, they are going to be part of a same structure. So we are looking at that. Now, in addition to them obtaining contested routes, you will find SAA having a technical services unit, you find SAA having a technical services unit. Could you watch them? And therefore watch those assets and do better with that merged entity. I think those are the questions that we are asking. I think in the next few years, we can tell this turnaround strategy. It's a frontier strategy, but it also has short, medium objectives, because there are urgent issues it must respond to which are facing SMA now. I've heard many people asking this question, why a 20-year strategy when there are many challenges at SMA? Our answer is there are short-term targets of a 10-year horizon which respond to the immediate challenges which SMA is facing. So they will respond together with that to the immediate challenges as well as the broader question of the existence of SMA, SM Express, Mango. Existed at the moment, and how do we change the shareholding of all of those assets? In the next few years, the whole scenario would be different. And we are confident that we will receive necessary support from governments for that change of direction. I must say, I'm a great advocate of national carrier. I support SAA. The Minister of North Minister of Public Enterprises, I will support SAA. Thank you. This adds tremendous value to our national pride to have our flag up in the sky competing with the best in the world. But it also contributes to our GDP. It brings tourism to South Africa. It keeps 11,000 people employed. It takes South Africa abroad. It allows our currency to reach areas where which ordinarily we will not reach. It ensures that on South African skies, you do not have to another point of destination. So, a great supporter of South African aid. A second, I'm a great supporter of efficiency. And I believe that anything, there is any state-owned company, which is not a state-owned company, mainly because it is owned by the state to be run efficiently. Wastefully, recklessly. I think that we can run these companies as efficiently as any other institution is run. And I believe that the most of mental crisis that the world, economic crisis the world has gone through started from the private sector. So nobody can stand up with any confidence to say that the private sector is more inherently more efficient than the state. The state is inefficient if it wants to. Just as the private sector, if it chooses to shut its eyes to its own failures and inefficiencies, then it will be inefficient and it will fail. SAA solves problems that the private sector will not solve. Well, if you want your experience, if you want your verses and people, they are quite touched. But I'm quite glad that the one they have executed their responsibilities and discharged their mandate with admiration. We assess both collectively and individuals on an annual basis. And based on that, we take decisions about whether we should retire you from the board or not. The issue of retention of boards, especially in the last 2 years, has actually caused some consternation in the country. Which we should expect to be natural. Except in instances where people retire maybe animals, which should be a cause for alarm, but when both are systematically mandated, you should take that as natural because you are ensuring good governance. No board member must serve any single board for a period of longer than 6 years. 3 years consecutive. That because when we assess the board, we look at the challenges the company is facing, we go through these annual reports and determine whether we are going to meet in terms of MSK, and we might decide that number X must request number X to retire so that we replace them with number Y. So the method to what we are doing, when we pay great attention, when we don't start looking at board retentions and retirements close to the ATMs, we start that process long ago, and we are supported in that by our legal and government mandate, by the memorandum of incorporation, by the mandate of these companies, the assessment of the board, the reports that the board themselves submit to us on a persistent basis. So even though we try to keep the membership that each board member of the board, the membership of other boards that each board member might have, it does in instances prove difficult, and we realize that a particular number when we thought would add a particular value is kind of stretched. We can take the decision to retire them so that we try and find others who might have the time. Because it's quite clear when we look at many of our companies that they demand a lot of attention. If you look at SMA, members of the board of SMA are demanded to pay attention to this company a great deal. And in short term, you expect them to have the time not to limit their participation to attend the board meetings, but to perform other functions of the board and attend committee meetings of the board and ensure that all those committees are functioning. As we have been drafting the panorama strategy, the board was meeting every week. The members of the attack committee, the task team was established to track the turnaround strategy, were meeting every Thursday. It was very demanding of them. And I really applaud them for having made themselves available for this work. The question of internal controls are quite important to us. And in the chapter forum, where the shareholders are met with all the chairs and CEOs of the companies in our portfolio twice a year, we place the issue of internal controls as a standing item, so that we will present to them the risks as well as assessed from the reports they submit to us and tell them to best practice
ourselves within the portfolio so that we can care for each other's strengths and assist towards dealing with the weaknesses of some members in our portfolio who might be needing assistance. So we let's the task of showing the management. It's our only responsibility for our chapters we do it with. Some other people are saying that to be overbearing, to be burning. We think that active sharing is something worth pursuing, especially in a country where state companies can contribute so much. The state companies in our portfolio in a particular direction towards supporting industrialization, towards supporting transformation. We are harnessing the procurement budget and the capital expenditure towards supporting the transformation agenda and towards supporting the industrialization efforts of our government. We are still the highest season. We are fine, for example, that we are bringing together SNI, SNS Press, as well as Demand Aviation, towards developing a maintenance, repair, and overhaul capability for the country. Because these three companies must be able to support one another in that regard, to develop that capability for South Africa and ensure that out of their existence can be procurement of this aircraft by the fleet by SAA and SAS Press. We are able to develop an effective repair and maintenance and overhaul capability in the country. We are harnessing self-core and self-core towards developing biofuels and SAA towards developing the biofuels sector. So there are many areas where we are coordinating these companies. It demands them that in addition to doing what they have to do as their principal unit, they do more. But Chairperson, thank you very much for the critical question that the committee has asked. There's a point that's in the right direction, and we are confident that, you know, if they can make it right, and no doubt about it, I have no doubt in my mind, if they can make it right, we have no option but to get it right. So we are focused on that task on a daily basis. We are focused on the task on a functioning that is going to deliver same power. We are focused, there are areas which we have defined as our immediate objectives, and we are focused on those. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. No. Not that far. But thanks very much, Comrade Minister. complete. Okay, but thank you very much for response. But and also for this interaction, DG. We appreciate your presence, the chairperson of the board, the acting CEO, and all the officials who are here, National Treasury. We appreciate your presence. I'm sure you were focusing on the guarantee that they must say the right things, that you don't have to do that painful act of signing the check. The Auditor General's Office, as well as the Joint Auditors, we thank you very much for the assistance that you've given us in preparing for this engagement. Comrade Minister, the assertion around efficiency on public and private entities is is a purely ideological statement and must be treated as such. Efficiency, mismanagement are purely administrative functions. That follows the same logic everywhere, whether it's private or public. So I think we're all together on that one. Comrades, there is no meeting tomorrow. It was supposed to be a plenary session of Parliament, so we left it out, but now we understand there's no plenary session, so it's a Mombara day, so to speak, in terms of work. Comrades, thanks very much. Our meeting is adjourned.